Hello there, I'm Kevin Rothrock, the managing editor of Meduza's English Language Edition, and welcome back to another episode of The Naked Pravda. Earlier this week, the European Union passed a landmark agreement banning most Russian oil imports into the region by the end of the year, though the embargo features a temporary exemption for imports delivered by pipeline in order to overcome opposition from landlocked Hungary. In late May, the U.S. Treasury declined to extend a license that allowed Russia to make payments on its sovereign debt to U.S. holders, possibly accelerating the prospect of Russia finally defaulting on its government debt. To discuss these major developments and more happening in the sanctions campaign against Russia in response to its invasion of Ukraine, The Naked Pravda welcome back Dr. Maria Shagina, a political risk analyst and sanctions expert who works as a Diamond Brown Research Fellow for Economic Sanctions, Standards, and Strategy at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. So let's jump into the interview. Russia's current account surplus. Please explain what that is, because I vaguely understand what that means. It's something to do with trade, I think. It's higher than ever. What's going on here? Because I was under the impression that the Russian economy was supposed to be in the gutter now, and that Russians are supposed to be trading with like bits of leaves or like bark or something. Like, how is this? How is the economy still standing? What is this? What's this news about the current account surplus mean?
Yeah, as you said, the Russian economy didn't crumble, didn't collapse, and that gives this false sense of stability, something the Russian officials would be eager to underline, that everything is fine, right? Don't worry, we can survive Western sanctions, even these unprecedented measures. And that comes from two factors here. First is damage control that was executed after sanctions kicked in February this year. And it was rather skillful intervention by the central bank, other officials who were quick because they were prepared for some of the measures. They were preparing for Fortress Russia strategy that wasn't unique. In this case, we're talking about introduction of obligation to on the exporters to bring back hard currency up to 80%. So they were forced to sell it back to the state. There are also strong capital controls and foreign exchange restrictions. So that tamed the capital outflow. And the second part of it is that we have a situation where imports collapse substantially up to 50%, some countries even 70%, like South Korea, Taiwan, who are responsible for all of this high-tech stuff like semiconductors, and even China, the big partner, strategic partner of Russia, we see that imports collapse by 25%. At the same time, Russia continues exporting hydrocarbons. So we have this very uneven situation where the Russian government is hoarding cash. It can be proud of this mountains of cash it's sitting on, but it can't spend it on anything. It can't buy things.
Is it using this cash to pay off to prolong the default? Does that play into that equation, or is that something separate?
It's just because the imports collapse and you have a combination of sanctions, export controls that just don't allow you to bring anything to Russia that is on the sanctions list or export controls, but also the disruption of supply chains. Some companies just are not willing to engage with Russia.
Right. But you said they have this mountain of cash. Is that what they're using to pay off the government debts to keep themselves out of default? So is the cash coming in useful in that regard, or is it literally just piling up for no good reason?
Fortunately, because we had the general license from OFAC.
From the U.S. Treasury.
Right.
Yeah.
So that allowed the Russian state to tap into those frozen assets.
Yeah.
But now the policy has changed and the Russian officials are offering, we can pay you in rubles, this nice currency that we're trying to use. But that, you know, they have used the cash that they accumulated, which means they're willing to play by the rules.
So they can draw on these. Are they accumulating dollars with this current account surplus, or is it all rubles?
No, it's rubles.
So in terms of you mentioned the central bank's interventions and the buying of hard currency, that's all in rubles, or is the central bank able to accrue foreign currency in that way? Like, can you explain, like, what exactly is the the hard currency 80% thing? Like, what is, how does that work in reality? What is that?
So before they would get hard currency, meaning Western currency, the dollars, right? Something that, or the euros, because the contracts has changed after 2014. And after this, after February this year, the exporters were forced to sell back hard currency back to the state and convert it into rubles. So that was the deal for the state.
In your view, has Western unity on sanctions against Russia, is it still growing? Is the coalition holding together, or are you seeing cracks? Is it, have we already hit peak unity and what's ahead is now more fractious?
I think it depends on your expectations. Mm-hmm. We did expect oil embargo to be early May, and now we waited for months at least. That was widely discussed. And the unity is the requirements on the unanimity is always stretching the limits of what they can do. So this was the case recently with Hungary. Mm-hmm. So to now, with every hard hitting measures that is ahead of us, which is gas embargo in this case, it will be hard to keep the unanimity and to bring everyone on board, 27 veto member states, veto powers. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the fact that the EU managed to bring everyone together, even for this very hard-hitting measure, something that was unthinkable a couple of months ago, can be a good sign for the union's agility. Mm-hmm. That it's still able to push and to find compromises to level playing field across the member states, because it's very hard to impose a unanimous ban on every country because of the different exposure of each member state towards Russian hydrocarbons.
Is the divide within the European Union, as you see it, is it like mostly in terms of receptivity to imposing sanctions on Russia? Would you say that is it more determined by economic necessity, like the countries that are hurt most by it are the least inclined to pursue that? Or is it like a question of political will, or is it like a mix of this? Because I know that Hungary is, as I understand it, it's particularly vulnerable to, it relies on Russia for oil more than, say, I don't know, France maybe. But as I also understand it, Germany's quite reliant on Russian oil, but it seems like they're more kind of gung-ho about, or maybe that's not the right term, but they're more willing to pursue these sanctions now. So in terms of how determinant sort of economic necessity and political will are, how would you sort of rate the two as factors in this?
This is something I actually worked on, and there is also proper research on how to, you know, map all of this.
Okay.
And there is no clear cut here.
Yeah.
And you can't say that Eastern Europe is Russia hawkish full stop. Uh-huh. We see Hungary, as you said, as something that these authoritarian ties binds the two countries together. So this is something that researchers analyzed from 2014, and the same pattern repeats this time as well. Countries like Poland and the Baltic states, despite their large exposure towards Russian hydrocarbons, also trade in general, they're willing to pay that price. Germany is obviously now the swing state that is being forced to change, and there is also a political component that needs to be changed, and also the international criticism that Germany is now facing. Mm-hmm. So it's always a combination of both.
Okay.
Of political and then economic. It's not really, it's hard to draw one line
I see. Is it your view that Germany has swung definitively toward the, I mean, I don't know if hawkish is the right word, but like they're now in the camp of let's go sanctions like all the way, let's win this economic war or whatever? Or is that a temporary thing, and once the costs are more felt by the German public, it's possible that it'll swing back and they'll say, okay, you know, this, we've done enough here?
I don't think we're there yet that Germany joined the Polish camp, for example.
Okay.
I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah.
There is definitely internal pressure from some parties. Also, the general population is more hawkish or more definitive on delivering weapons. It's not just sanctions, right, where Germany is hesitant.
Yeah.
But the government, this is the key to this public-private divide is also there. The government is very reluctant, and whether it's SPD could also play a role, a party that is, you know, responsible for this whole Ostpolitik, new Eastern policy towards Russia since the 70s, also plays a role. But the amount of international pressure that Germany is now facing is sort of pushing Germany towards where it maybe should be, in line with everyone else.
What about in terms of the looming food crisis or the potential food crisis? Is that entirely the result of Russia occupying Ukrainian farmlands and blockading Ukrainian shipyards and ports? In terms of all the factors of the that put the global food supply at risk, where does Russian military, direct military action in Ukraine play a role, and where do economic sanctions factor in?
The major impact doesn't come from sanctions necessarily, because agricultural food is usually excluded. This is this whole concept of smart sanctions, that you do not target food, medicals, and anything like this that is needed for humanitarian assistance. But we are in a very tricky situation where we have disruption of supply chains, we have blockade of Black Sea ports, and we have two countries that are responsible for 30% of wheat exports to the global south, and both are not being able to do so. And Russia is also blocking some of its internal products to ship abroad, which is only aggravates the problem.
I recently spoke to Emily Holland, who's at the U.S. Naval War College, and she's been writing and talking on podcasts recently about the risks that wealthy nations, basically about the trade-offs inherent in boycotting Russian energy, and the risk that wealthy nations will basically buy up the higher price fuel, crowding out poorer nations, effectively passing on, I mean, inadvertently passing on the costs of this policy of restricting Russian energy exports while sustaining their own kind of high levels of consumption of oil and gas, right? The idea being that, for instance, here in the United States, our gas prices have gone up, but you know, the political leadership is essentially saying, like, it's the message is not stop driving your car. It's like, well, we're going to get through this. Maybe there'll be some subsidies here and there. Like, you know, American way of life will thrive. And by doing that, somebody out in Pakistan maybe like won't be able to buy their heating oil like come winter or something like that. Is that something that, is that a phenomenon that you see happening, or is that not how you would describe it? And do you see, just sort of generally, this is something it seems to me that the Russian leadership is sort of hoping for and counting on, that the West is essentially leading this economic sanction push against Russia. And I mean, the narrative is that the world is against Russia. The sanctions are, as far as I understand it, really led by Western powers, and to some degree, some Asian powers too. But that there are costs to this, obviously, and the West isn't necessarily going to show, the West will pay a higher price for the things that it consumes, but that has consequences for people in the global South that aren't necessarily party to this whole conflict, not directly anyway, and that they'll be given costs, essentially, that as a result of this, and that could potentially turn opinion against the West, possibly. Now, that's not an ethical judgment, it's just sort of the way that the economics and the politics will shake out. What's your assessment of that sort of story?
I'll come back to your U.S. example. And having moved to Berlin today, I just discovered, because of the rise in energy prices, they slashed the ticket for public transportation to incentivize everyone to take public trams and buses.
I see. So, we have not done that in the United States.
But this is something, you know, to think about, and also about your domestic resilience and energy efficiency, because Ukraine's definitely been on a quiet journey to improve it. But having moved in a Berlin apartment, it's quite chilly here. You know, to increase energy efficiency would also be good here as well. In terms of, I would say, in a way, because we're in this unprecedented crisis situation, Russia is also paying the price in terms of oil discounts. So countries like India are ramping up, or India and China ramping up Russian oil at $35 discount, which is unprecedented. Mm-hmm. So perhaps they can, you know, use it then better locally, allocate it. It is true that in this case, ordinary Russians and the countries from the global south will be hit the most. Also, this brings us back to the food crisis. But in this situation, as I would always indicate, this is existential versus economic costs. For Ukrainians, they will face a very cold winter, I mean, physically, because we don't know what will happen with the heating in Ukraine. So from a Ukrainian perspective, the fact that some countries are disputing, you know, things that happened in Bucha and so on, or are not joining sanctions regimes, sometimes is seen that, you know, you're not part of this game. You don't think that might affect you. But I think now we need to understand that this is the war in Ukraine is much larger than, you know, something happening in Eastern Europe that will go beyond economic costs, and it will go to international rules and laws. Some countries, like Taiwan, is also under threat here.
It sounds as though there will indeed be costs for the global south, and it'll be sort of a question for, you know, future historians as to how they handle that, right? I mean, whether they interpret it as evidence of our shared humanity, or whether they say, well, hold on, Western countries, like, stop making us pay more for things because you're boycotting stuff.
Well, some countries are buying Russian propaganda on this. Mm-hmm. African countries, Southeast Asia, and they could potentially be the countries through which Russia either can circumvent sanctions, like, you know, getting semiconductors from, let's say, Malaysia or Indonesia for Russia. And they would say, well, we don't care, largely speaking, because the war in Ukraine is too far from us and we're not part of it. We're sort of neutral on it.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to understand, as you say, the supply chains, the whole reverberations will be hit on the other side of the world as well, mm-hmm. whether you want it on or not. The other, I think, development here that so far has been felt within the EU, but also transatlantically, that the understanding of a share of burden sharing has been stepped up. Mm-hmm. So the US is very keen on, you know, providing more energy towards Europe because of its high reliance on hydrocarbons. The EU within itself is willing to step into countries who are, you know, too dependent and so, or don't have access to sea, like Hungary. So the understanding of this burden sharing, whether it will reach this international level and, you know, go to the global south and they say, we need to also chip in for those countries when it comes to the export of wheat, for example, in Africa or in Egypt, who will be hit the most, Indonesia as well. That's a big question mark. I don't have an exact answer how much willingness the Europeans or the Americans have to pay for those countries.
Uh-huh. What about impact on like green agenda, green reform? You know, like I've seen some people say that this is going to be great because it's going to really stimulate the needed transition to green sources of energy because they're going to have to break away from Russia. And I've seen other people say like this is a nightmare for the green agenda. Now you've got the U.S. is Biden's like not even talking about the environment anymore. It's just he's just going to people. It's basically like drill, drill, drill. We've got to, like, you know, supplement what we're losing from Russia now. So, what's your impression of the immediate and long term impact on the environmental needs of the planet?
Yeah, I think short term we need to acknowledge that we're going back. You know, in terms of development, we're resorting more often to coal, something that we thought will phase out by now, and will rely to gas, as it was seen from Germany as this bridge to the renewable future. Now we're going back one step back in this direction. Mm-hmm. But this is the short term, right? Because we need to impose those hard-hitting measures, you need some short-term supplies of oil and gas. And this is something that can be done with those measures that were supposed not to be part of this discussion anymore as a green transition. But the long-term, this is something that I think will go even faster than it was projected. So now the EU is talking, as part of its Repower EU plan, is talking to end, not just to reduce or, you know, somehow minimize Russian fuels by the end of 2027. Mm-hmm. That is, I would say, quite revolutionary if it manages to do so by that time. But also politically, Russia will no longer be this energy bridge, something that it has used for a long time historically as its foundation to build relations to the Europeans. And the very fabric of this relationship between Russia and the EU will no longer be there. And if we go back after starting with decarbonization, slated for 2030, 2050, depending on the progress here, Russia will not find its place here because Moscow will need access to technology, advanced technology in this case, for something that even Western countries doesn't necessarily have, and capital, because it's very capital intensive to build those things. Mm-hmm. So in this case, its place is no longer with Europe. It's somewhere with Asia, perhaps resorting to Chinese funders, to other technology of lesser standards. But that is a very different, economic structure that Russia will have to go through. And this is what the Central Bank of Russia said. Well, we'll go through structural transformation and reverse industrialization. So it will be interesting.
But so you see evidence that the EU, and I don't know about the United States in this case, but the EU is they'll accelerate their long-term transition to green energies as a result of this?
I think so.
Have leaders actually change the timeline for this officially, or is it this is just like an opportunity at this point?
From what I understood, so the timeline was a bit changed. So before the war was phasing out Russian fossil fuels by 2030, mm-hmm. the Repower EU plan tells us we will end it by 2027.
And replace it with green energy.
With green energy, but also with other suppliers, not necessarily green, but at this point, mm-hmm. LNG is still factored in. So I think diversifying away from Russia is probably a stronger component here at the moment. Whether everything will be green, we'll have to see. Mm-hmm. But I think after 2050, where it was supposed to kick in this Fit 55 project as well, this is where Russia won't find its place in Europe. So
right. So do you think that I suppose this is always a long ways coming. And politically speaking, like Russia's turn to the East has been something that's been discussed for years now. But it sounds as though the war and the sanctions have made this like inevitable now. It's no longer just that Putin's too nasty to be kind of to shake his hand for Western leaders. It's like the whole economy has to just turn away from Europe. It's not going to have business there anymore. And I mean, it just seems like that's going to have a profound impact on like Russian society and so on. It seems like a pretty major thing to put it in these terms.
Well, the previous pivots to Asia were always propelled by the deteriorated relationship with the West.
Yeah.
So it was always the idea, okay, we won't need you. We have other countries, meaning China in this case.
Right.
So it was always the desire to play the two against each other. Now it has only one game in town, and that's China, maybe India.
Yeah.
And learning from 2014, that those countries will help, will mitigate some of it, but that help will not come cheaply. Mm-hmm. And also they will try to capitalize on Russia's international isolation. So we're already seeing the Chinese energy companies are sweeping all of the assets left by Western companies. They're ramping up very cheap now Russian oil. And that will proceed to a certain extent, but whether they will be willing to, let's say, violate Western sanctions, I'm not so certain. So the other solution for Russia here would be to team up with those sanctioned countries. Mm-hmm. But this is a very bleak picture because you're teaming up with Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, right? You have good friends all around.
Right.
But this is the type of survival regime. Mm-hmm. Oh, and this is quite bleak for ordinary Russians, as you said.
You've been listening to The Naked Pravda, an English language podcast from Medusa. On today's show, we discuss the current state of economic sanctions against Russia and their global reverberations. You heard from Dr. Maria Shagana, a political risk analyst and sanctions expert who works as a Diamond Brown Research Fellow for Economic Sanctions, Standards, and Strategy at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. The Naked Pravda is a podcast from Medusa. It's our only English language show, and I hope you'll recommend us to your friends and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in to help put this program in front of more people. Also, if you value Medusa's reporting, whether in English or Russian, please consider making a donation at support.medusa.io. You could throw a little dash EN if you want it in English to help sustain our work. Recurring pledges help the most, but we will take whatever you can spare, of course. Thank you for listening and come back soon.